Hello, listeners. It is Thursday, September 14th. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. I'm back after a few weeks off caring for a newborn at home. Very excited to be here and very excited to jump into this week's topics. There was a lot going on this week. Just on Wednesday, we had a couple major policy proposals coming out, one a little more concrete than the other, but the key thing that they have in common is that Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All proposal and the possible deal on Dreamers and DACA that President Trump is said to have outlined at a meeting with Democratic leaders last night, both are dividing the parties of the protagonists. Sanders' proposal is very controversial among Democrats, although a lot of the potential 2020 presidential candidates have signed on to it. Trump made immigration a signature issue of his during the campaign and is already getting blowback from his base over a potential legislative fix to DACA. Other things we're going to talk about this week. There have been three retirements by House Republicans in potential battleground districts over the last week. We'll talk about who they are, where they came from, and what it means in terms of the battle for the House in 2016 as Democrats are trying to target the 24 districts they would need to take back the majority. And then we're going to take a quick turn into foreign policy at the end of the program. The United Nations General Assembly is next week. It's going to be President Donald Trump's first. It's going to be Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's first. It's going to be United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley's first. And so we're going to talk a little bit about what that means and some of the internal movement and machinations inside Trump's foreign policy team over the last few months. Before we jump into that, a couple quick housekeeping notes. First, remember, you can email us at nerdcast@politico.com if you have questions. We'd love to hear from you. And along those lines, please remember, subscribe, rate us. If you have time, even write a written review of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Definitely subscribe. We love being in your ear every week. With that, let's turn to our panel. We have, as usual, senior politics editor Charlie Mutessian.
Hey, Scott.
Hi, Charlie. We have national political reporter Eliana Johnson.
Hola.
And White House reporter Nancy Cook.
Hello.
All right. So like we said in the intro, we're going to start off today talking about two policy proposals, both kind of rolled out, although in one through the media, one through an actual bill on Wednesday, that are both dividing the parties of the protagonist. So let's start with single payer. And our data point on that is the number 17. That's the number of Democratic senators backing Bernie Sanders' new single-payer health care legislation, introduced Wednesday.
Today, we say the function of a rational health care system is to provide quality care to all in a cost-effective way, and not to continue a system which allows insurance companies and drug companies to make hundreds of billions of dollars in profits each year.
Nancy, let's start off. Can you just summarize what's in this bill? And you know, we know it's a big deal. This would be an enormous shift in the U.S. healthcare system, kind of a progressive pipe dream for decades. But what's actually in it?
Yeah, so basically it would take Medicare and it would expand it over the course of 4 years, first to people 55 and then, you know, 45 and then 35 and then everyone. And it would do away with other programs like Medicaid. And it would basically, you know, expand government health care in a huge way. And there would be some things along that would go along with expanded coverage. Like it would cover, for instance, eye appointments and dentists. And it would get rid of premiums and deductibles and copays that a lot of medical care has, which is can be quite significant for people. But the other thing that it would do is, you know, it would also try to rein in costs in Medicare by potentially paying doctors less or paying hospitals less. So it would both expand it, but then also put Medicare on a bit of a diet. What wasn't necessarily in Sanders' plan was a great amount of details about the way that he would pay for it, and that's really a key thing. You know, there's been some talk of increasing payroll taxes to pay for it or raising taxes on high-income earners. But really, if you're going to expand government health care for that, you know, the estimates have been anywhere from $16 trillion to $32 trillion of increased money that it would require. And, you know, that's a really key element that the Sanders plan doesn't necessarily get into.
Well, and that's the whole thing, right? That's why there's opposition to it. It would be, you know, people pay a lot for healthcare now, and some of that money would get rolled into taxes. But you'd have to sell people on new taxes. You'd have to sell people on changing their private insurance, which was the kind of the one of the big reasons why Obamacare became so unpopular in Obama's second term, right? It was because people who had been promised they wouldn't have to change their private insurance, in fact, did have to. Any sort of plan like this would do away with that premise from the get-go. I mean, it's one of many obstacles, political obstacles, that stand in the way of this sort of thing.
Well, I also just think, like, broadly, politically, it's the idea that the government would be much more responsible for the way healthcare is run, far, far beyond what we've seen with the Affordable Care Act. And that's really something that Republicans and conservatives don't believe the government should be involved in. I think they would call it an overreach. And, you know, it would also mean that the government would decide potentially like what medical treatments are covered or how much to pay hospitals and doctors. And that's something that, you know, makes conservatives really uncomfortable, while some Democrats and some progressives are really think that this is a great idea, that it would make ultimately healthcare more affordable for people, excuse me, and it would cover a greater swath of people.
Charlie, who's backing this? I mean, a lot of them have one very big thing in common in the Senate.
What is that, Charlie? Yeah.
I think this is the rapidly emerging as the litmus test for the 2020 Democratic presidential field. And the politics of it are pretty fascinating, because you hear some folks even on the left say it's political suicide for us, yet you see the 2020 field all embracing this. And, you know, to begin with, I would say I'm hesitant to call anything political suicide anymore.
Yeah.
You know, all the old rules that govern politics for decades are out the window or are in the process of being rewritten in this era. But the politics are going to be a problem. And starting with this, let's admit right now, I think the dirty little secret here is that this is in some aspects a bumper sticker solution. And that is often the most trenchant Democratic criticism about Republican policy proposals. And I think that, you know, there's a an aspect of this. We haven't heard much from Sanders either on the campaign trail or even now about how things are going to be paid for. We're talking about a massive expansion of federal government, and that is just not something that the national electorate has shown it is ready for. And
they might agree with the values statement in it that people should be guaranteed health care, but they're not necessarily on board with the how you get it done.
Exactly. And the polls reflect that. The polls reflect that, sure, you know, most everybody thinks the value statement part of it is right where it needs to be. And the polls show there's a lot of support for it. But the polls also show, when you drill down into them, the more you ask, the more you talk about the implications, the costs, what it will do to the size of government, the lower the numbers get. And so, you know, we really haven't had at least any kind of meaningful conversation on the details. So it's hard to say, you know, about what the politics are going to look like. But right now, the presidential contenders all understand what direction the party is going. And they understand that Bernie Sanders, you know, the figurehead of the
direction
most...
would be left.
Yes, the party's moving leftward.
Just to be clear.
Right. The base is more liberal than ever. And the figurehead of the most energetic wing of the Democratic Party is behind this. So all of these 2020 contenders are looking to the future, and they understand this is a price of entry to the 2020 Democratic primaries. But when it comes to people – but it's also, I think, instructive to see that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are not embracing this in any way.
Medicare for All bill that a number
well, look,
of senators have
Democrats on. Believe that health care is a right for all. And there are many different bills out there. There are many good ones. Senator Sanders has a bill. Senator Schatz has a bill on Medicaid buy-in. Senator Stabenow, who's here, has a bill on buy-in for Medicare.
And that is because while they may be fans of the idea in theoretical terms, I mean, Nancy Pelosi is an old school liberal. She has to think in more practical terms in terms of the universality of the Democratic Party and whether it can play in all corners of the country.
She also has to protect a lot of House seats that are in more conservative districts in 2018, and it's trying to win in a lot of more conservative districts.
I think that's the key. They're trying to win, yeah.
If they want to retake the House. But the most interesting thing about this, I thought, was Pelosi came out and crapped all over this, and Schumer essentially did too. But for all the talk about how divided the Republican Party is, which is true, the Democratic Party, I think, is also bitterly divided between people who want to see a return to the sort of centrist politics of Bill Clinton and people who really think that the in the debate between Hillary Clinton in 2016 and Bernie Sanders, it was really Bernie Sanders who represented the heart of the Democratic Party and its future. And what's so surprising about this bill is that everybody from Kirsten Gillibrand to Cory Booker to many others who people who are young in presidential process, they all signed on to this bill, really affirming, I think, the people who argued that the Democratic Party was moving not only to the left, but really to the far left, and that Sanders really did capture the hearts and minds and represent the future of the Democratic Party. But I think there are going to be some increasingly bitter fights as we get closer and closer to 2020 about who it is who represents the future of the party and where it should be going.
Well, one thing that I thought was interesting in all this is that the one place where the Venn diagram overlaps between like the 2018 battleground Senate races and the potential 2020 contenders is in Ohio with Sherrod Brown, which Trump won by I think 8 or 9 points in 2016. And Brown is not backing the Sanders bill, but the way he's not backing it, I thought was interesting. He said something along the lines of, "I've always supported the idea of Medicare for all, but I would rather focus on what I think is a more workable, potentially bipartisan solution, which is just lowering the age to 55 and leaving it there for now."
Sort of a classic battleground senator up for re-elections answer. I'd be very curious to know whether Sherrod Brown would have the same proposal if he was 2 years into a new term that he had just been elected to.
That's an interesting question. Just a few pieces of data here. So the Kaiser Family Foundation has aggregated some polling on this, and it does show that support has been slowly but steadily increasing for the concept of single-payer health care in the country over the last couple decades. Early 2000s, it was about 40%. 08, 09, 46%. And again, this is Democrats were negotiating Obamacare in 2009, and single payer didn't really enter into the equation even. Then by February 2016, 50%. In June 2017, up to 53%, a majority for the first time in Kaiser polls, saying that they would support all Americans getting their insurance from a single government plan.
Going to be a buzzkill.
Yeah, polling.
So we'll see what happens with that. Let's shift quickly, though, to talk about that other policy proposal that we promised discussion of. And so late last night, early this morning, it started to come out that President Trump had this big meeting with Democratic leadership at the White House last night. And there's talk of him essentially acquiescing to a legislative fix for DACA, the deferred action program.
The nerds know what DACA is.
Okay.
Bland.
And which, you know, tied to some sort of border security funding, but not necessarily tied to the border wall that Trump promised during his campaign. Eliana, can you summarize a little bit what's happened over the last 24 hours on this? It kind of came as a bolt out of the blue.
To some
last night. Exactly.
The president had Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, his new besties, over for dinner at the White House.
Chinese food.
Yep.
I love that detail.
Yeah, it's a very Jewish touch.
As you know, last night, Leader Schumer and I had a very productive meeting with President Trump, where we agreed to a plan to work out an agreement to protect our nation's dreamers from deportation, and that we would review border security measures that do not include building a wall.
So this is something that has set some of the president's most vehement supporters, people like Ann Coulter, off. They're incensed that he would make a trade that doesn't seem to them like Republicans or conservatives are getting enough in return. But it seems to me that the president all along was uncomfortable with getting rid of DACA. He really wanted to keep these people here. And in my view, look, anybody who was watching Donald Trump in the Republican primaries, seeing him attack every single one of the Republicans' previous nominees from John McCain to Mitt Romney to George W. Bush, seeing him attack openly Republican leadership, should have known that this president is not aligned with Republicans. He's essentially a rhino. and it should come as no surprise that he's striking deals with Democrats to do what he wants done. The president wants DACA enshrined in law, essentially. And I think from his perspective, he's he's moving down a path to what to him looks like a good deal. The question to me is, if Democrats are leading this deal, but Republicans control both houses of Congress, can he get enough Republicans to go along with this?
And we're about to, I think, explore the boundaries of what the Trump base will accept and won't accept. I mean, I'm an adherent to Trump's belief that his own base, that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and his base would still stay with him. I mean, we've sort of seen that in the first 6 months. I mean, it didn't matter what the scandal was, didn't matter about any of the chaos, any of the statements, any of the aberrant behavior. None of it mattered to the base. It was unshakable. This, though, I suspect could be something that rattles them in a way that we haven't seen before. I mean, it's as close to a third rail issue for Trump as it gets, I think, with the Trump Republican base.
Eliana, where do you see that going at this point? I mean, you especially let's talk about that in terms of congressional Republicans, right? Who, as we've talked many times, are in a lot they are forced to be attuned to Trump's base as much as anyone, because that also happens to be the base that they rely on, and they have to run for re-election more often than Trump does.
Look, my general view on this has been that Trump's base is going to remain loyal to him, but Trump needed much more than his base, which represents maybe 25 or 30% of the country, to win the election. And what he risks doing is alienating the other, you know, 20, 25% of people who voted for him, because he promised to appoint Supreme Court justices like Neil Gorsuch, because he had an R by his name. And if those people who sought reassurance from the fact that he was, you know, not a nominal Republican begin to realize that, no, actually, this guy looks more like a Democrat, it's those people who may flee and begin to actually vote for the other party, fortify the resistance against him, and so on. But I don't think the people who are fervent adherents to, you know, Trumpism because they wanted to see Washington shaken up, which he's actually doing by throwing Republicans and Democrats off their game, are going to desert him.
But is that shaking up Washington, though? I mean, in some ways, it's a core shared value between him and his base. It's not really a swamp-related issue.
Well, I think he's kind of giving it to the Republican leadership, which I think is something that his base likes. And he's not ideologically driven.
I just think it's interesting because it's coming off of that debt ceiling deal that he cut also with Chuck and Nancy, as he now likes to call them. And, you know, I heard from I was reporting a story earlier this week on tax reform and how that's going. And there were a lot of conservative Republicans in the House and sort of conservative outside groups that were pissed about that debt ceiling deal and felt like that wasn't what they wanted. And they were going to be asked to make some hard choices on tax reform. And so there were already some nervousness about that. And also there's also just some nervousness about cabinet members like Secretary Mnuchin and Gary Cohen, the White House's top economic advisor, and their political leanings. Gary Cohen is still a registered Democrat. And so I feel like this DACA thing just sort of sets up another data point for them to say, well, is Trump going to have our back or not on this next big legislative priority of tax reform? And I feel like there's a concern that particularly now with this DACA thing that he might not.
That's a really good point. All right, let's talk about another big development on the Hill this week, and that's House retirements. Our second data point is 3. That's how many House Republicans from potential battleground districts have retired in the last week. It started with Congressman Dave Reichert of Washington. He was followed at the door by Charlie Dent of Pennsylvania, and then just a couple days ago, Dave Trott of Michigan, who's only been around for a couple terms, announced that he, too, would not run for re-election in 2018. Charlie, in addition to the potential battleground district aspect, all three of these Republicans come from the same side of the Republican Party, and they've all voiced similar reasons for leaving. They're frustrated. There's not much getting done, and they've kind of had enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's a similar complaint that we've heard in recent years. And, you know, when you boil it down to its essence, it's this. Members are acknowledging that it sucks to be a member of Congress. This is not the fantasy or the dream you had when you were a kid that you were going to go like Jimmy Stewart to Capitol Hill and change the world. It's not like that at all. It is an awful business. It is awful being a member of Congress, to work so hard, have your family dragged through the mud, have to go through the demeaning process of raising all that money. You get to Washington and nothing happens and people hate you. And so it's partly a reflection of that. But what I think we're seeing, and the reason we're even talking about these last three over the last week, it is a certain species of congressman is leaving. leaving. That should be very worrisome to the Republican Party. We've got three relative moderates from the Republican conference, people who represent districts that are largely suburban or at least moderate, non-Freedom Caucus type districts, the kind of districts that if the Democrats are going to make enough gains to overcome the 24-seat Republican majority, they must come from this class of seats. These are the most vulnerable ones because they're the ones that are most urbanized. They're the ones that Hillary Clinton tended to do pretty well in. They are suburban districts, places where Trump is not especially popular, that are sort of vaguely Republican, but not necessarily. And so that is very problematic if Republicans are bailing from those seats. And I think Republicans understand that now.
And the reason is because the political environment is not positive for Republicans right now. And if you once you take incumbents out of the equation, the more open seats there are, those seats are more vulnerable to the environment, right? They're more vulnerable to that swing in kind of in feeling as opposed to particular strengths that those incumbents have built up. Like Dave Reichert, for example, he was like a celebrity sheriff before he was in Congress. He helped solve a major serial killer case yeah. in Washington.
Yeah, and these are very unique places. So Reichert is from the Seattle suburbs, King County. They're, you know, it's not a place that's especially receptive to Republicans. These are unique political characters that often fought very fierce crosswinds in the places they came from. We're talking about, in Charlie Dent's case, the Lehigh Valley in Michigan. The other seat we're talking about Oakland County. So these are not necessarily Republican strongholds or Trump bastions. And what's interesting, if you think of the Michigan seat, that is an Oakland County seat. Now, Michigan had two counties right next to each other that were fascinating. There's Macomb County, sort of famed home of the Macomb County Reagan Democrats, the working class Democrats of Macomb County. That voted for Trump this year. But even though Macomb County voted for Trump, even though Michigan voted for Trump, Oakland County did not. It stayed Democratic. It is historically Republican that has been moving to the left over the years. It stayed Democratic. So that is the kind of place where a Democratic message could take hold. And if that's the case, if there's going to be a Democratic majority, and I'm a little skeptical that they can get the numbers to win back a majority, but if it happens, it's going to be rooted in these kinds of suburban-oriented districts.
And Eliana, Charlie's skepticism about whether or not Democrats really are going to be able to challenge for the majority is shared among Republicans on the Hill at this point, right? That there's not a sense of panic emerging necessarily about the, you know, if there's another three or another six like later this month, maybe that would change. But it's not setting off the loudest of alarm bells at this point, right?
I think that's true. The year is kind of similar to 2006. When Republicans lost 30 seats, I think, but they have a 241 to 184 majority, and the Democrats have to net 24 seats.
That's a lot. It's a ton.
And the Republican, you know, political analysts and consultants I've talked to think there are about 26 flip opportunities for Democrats if you include the lean R's and the likely R seats. So flipping 24 out of 26 seats they have a huge challenge on their hands, right? And it would be an enormously big year for Democrats if they succeeded in flipping all those seats.
Right. The question is, so does the battlefield expand? Does the battlefield continue to expand, you know, over the next 12, 14 months, which is eminently possible, or are they forced to kind of pour everything they've got into that narrow band? I mean, one of the ways the battlefield could expand is more retirements, like we just talked about. And one of the ways there could be more retirements is if there's this continued feeling that they're getting nothing done, which, Nancy, is why you've been keeping such a close eye on tax reform. And like you just mentioned, this is kind of emerging as the big opportunity. But there's nothing guaranteed at all about that opportunity.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think inside the White House and the Treasury Department, just the administration broadly, they view tax reform as this thing that Republicans, a core Republican value that the business community wants and outside conservative groups want. And, you know, they feel like they'll be able to build support in a way that they couldn't necessarily for health care, because that's not really an issue that animates Republicans that much, apart from getting rid of Obamacare. But they feel like tax reform is this great bet. And I think that that's why there is this nervousness, as I talked about in the first segment, of whether or not Trump is going to cut a deal with Democrats to do tax reform, or whether or not he'll sort of do what the Republicans want, because they see it as this way to have a victory, like a big legislative victory and a package and a bill signing in the Rose Garden ahead of the 2018 midterms.
If you're looking at, I think, the conditions, there are some really favorable things for the Democratic Party. Number one is this hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but there have been a series, maybe even scores, of special legislative elections. Here I'm talking about state legislative seats that don't get covered nationally, that have gone to the Democratic candidate. Places that have historically been very favorable to Republicans, some conservative places, and that is a reflection of Democratic energy. And I think many of them are very telling. They're very revealing, and Republicans should be worried about seats like that. And then also the other, you know, X factor here is Trump. The energy that Trump creates on the left, the antagonism they have for Trump. We don't know. Trump is so unpredictable. Who knows where things are going to be next fall? But on the other hand, the reasons why I'm skeptical are, number one, gerrymandering. And again, as you know, I'm not a big adherent to the gerrymandering as the source of all evils. I think that's kind of the lamest surface excuse for the state of politics right now. I mean, I think it is a serious problem, but it's not the font of all political evil. Having said that, the map as it is drawn right now makes it extremely difficult for Democrats to win back a majority. But then the other thing, when you're thinking about sort of the macro conditions, is what has the Democratic Party, if you did not like the Democratic Party or were not comfortable voting for Democratic candidates in November, what has changed? You know, so let's take Trump aside. We already talked about the Trump factor and how that could drive vote. But I mean, it's not as though their message is any more persuasive, powerful, or compelling. They're really struggling with that. And I don't know that there is the party has made.
That's
the
why they have to sign on to single payer universal. Medicare.
But the single payer idea is like a rerun from the Democratic primary of 2016, because like Sanders wanted to do that then and Clinton sort of bashed him up on it. And it was like this major sort of internal issue for Democrats. Like, you're right, Charlie, that alone, yes, it's gaining traction now among some circles of Democrats, but it's not a new idea. And I feel like that's what the Democrats are really searching for.
It seems to me, because of what you said, Charlie, about how the party writ large is struggling with the message, that in order to be competitive, to get those 24 seats that Eliana mentioned, a lot of it is going to rely on a lot of first-time candidates presenting themselves as more like non-political problem solvers in an individual district-by-district basis than on anything the party is doing writ large. And it might rely on that happening in some districts that maybe from 2012 through 2016 we didn't think of as districts that you had to go through to get to the House majority. There's seats in Texas and Southern California and Orange County, three Republican seats in New Jersey that were really never on Democratic target list before, but where Trump did quite poorly relative to past Republican nominees, and where you've got, you know, Navy veterans and there's like a lottery winner and businessman in California, and there's a bunch of, you know, Obama agency alumni in Texas who are running for these seats and trying to give these longtime members a challenge for the first time. And, you know, depending on how they calibrate their message, it might be that might be a really important factor.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think if you look at the map and the kinds of places that did not vote for for Democrats, they're not coming back. You know, Jacksonian America, all those places. If you thought that the Democrats were an elitist coastal party to begin with, nothing has changed to change your opinion. I think we're and I also think rural America is gone. I mean, it was mostly gone from the Democratic Party, with the exception of maybe the upper Mississippi Valley districts like western Wisconsin, southern Minnesota, places like that, you know, the Iron Range, all those places. That's not coming back either, I think, after the Trump election. But where I do think Democrats have a real opportunity to win back the majority. It's going to be in, if they win it back, it's going to happen this way. It's going to be in the suburbs of Philadelphia and Detroit and Chicago. It's going to be the sort of by heritage Republican suburban districts that are sort of in the middle now, may have voted for Clinton, may have voted for Trump with like 51%. It's going to be those places. It's going to be in the suburbs, and it's going to be in California, where there are about seven Republicans who have a very tenuous hold on their districts right now. And the all the immigration talk, all the hostility to a new diverse America is going to come back to haunt those Republicans. Some of them are very talented and have been around for quite a while and understand their constituencies and understand the difficulties of running as a California Republican. But some of them have been in office for a number of years and appear to have no clue about how to run in this kind of climate. And they just haven't been tested in a while. And I think they're ripe to be taken down.
I would add I agree with all that. I would add one thing to that. I think there is an argument to be made that Minnesota is the most interesting state right. in American politics right now, and especially with regards to the battle for the House. You have two or three seats held by rural Democrats. Still, some of the few seats still held by rural Democrats. One of them is open because Congressman Tim Walz is running for governor. So that's going to be really interesting to see if Democrats can hold on to that. And then in the suburbs outside the Twin Cities, you have a couple of Republicans who are holding on and who are going to be targeted heavily. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, that is the most interesting. Another interesting state will be Texas, oddly enough. And this is not the Texas is going purple argument, you know.
What was that argument again, Charlie?
Yeah, that awful, awful. I just cringe when I see those stories about Texas is going purple. You sort of read them on a regular basis every 3 months. No, here I'm talking about some of the suburban Dallas and Houston congressional districts, which are sort of pulling out away from the Republican fold, and I think are going to be interesting places to watch in the coming years.
All right. Well, for our final segment today, we're going to talk about foreign policy, and mercifully, we're doing it at a non-emergency moment for the first time this year. It does not look like we're all about to get blown up this week. And yet, despite that, we have foreign affairs correspondent Holly Tusi in the studio. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I would say it's about time.
All right. So our data point for the final segment is 193, and that is the number of nations coming together to meet at next week's United Nations General Assembly, which is the first one for President Trump and his foreign policy team, which are all new to that arena as well. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. We talked in the first two segments about things happening this week and last week and how those are developing going forward. What should we be looking for when the General Assembly kicks off next week in terms of driving the foreign policy of this administration over the next months, years going forward?
Well, it's an important moment for Trump because this is like his first truly global audience that he's come face to face with. And the tone that he strikes, either in private or in public, is going to go a long way toward getting cooperation or, even just help on a number of issues that are really important. And a couple of the things that particularly loom over this session this year are North Korea and the ongoing nuclear crisis with that country, as well as Iran. And the U.S. nuclear deal, I should say the internationally negotiated nuclear deal with Iran, and the concerns that Trump wants to basically find a way to get rid of that nuclear deal. Now, of course, there's also other crises, Syria, this unfolding displacement and killings of the Rohingya in Myanmar. There's a lot going on, and how Trump does, whether he kind of goes with this America first approach or America first but not America alone approach, that could have a real impact.
And this is all coming. It's been a year of major upheaval and change at the State Department in kind of American foreign policy in general, right, Eliana? And that a lot of those forces are coming to a head this week. And I know especially you're we've talked in the past. You're very interested in UN Ambassador Nikki Haley's role in the Trump administration and kind of more broadly in the Republican Party.
She's an interesting figure, but I think Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, is an interesting figure as well in that it's been difficult to discern kind of what his views are on a number of things. And like the president, he's not necessarily an ideological guy. And in many cases, he's distanced himself from the president, most vocally, of course, on Charlottesville. And there were many people who argued that he should have stepped down or been fired in the wake of that. And there's been, I think, a lot of disappointment in him from Republicans and conservatives. But in a job that that involves a lot of that has typically involved a lot of, public performance and public ceremony, he really has not embraced that role. Of course, at Exxon, he was rarely seen in public or photographed in public. But he's kind of taken that to the State Department and really left a void that UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who, of course, is governor of South Carolina, was used to having a real public profile. She was, of course, a rising star in the Republican Party and so on. But she's really filled this void that Tillerson has created and has almost been serving kind of as a shadow secretary of State, I would say. So I think next week's UN General Assembly will be really interesting to see what sort of role she plays. And it's kind of been whispered in the background that she's Tillerson's likely replacement. People are sort of think he'll stay between a year and 2 years, and that Haley, who had told the president when she talked with him during the transition that she didn't feel ready to take on the Secretary of State job initially, she wanted to get some experience, that she's used this UN job to get that experience, and that she's kind of, it's thought to be the next Secretary of State candidate. The UN job also, if you talk to people who have been in these circles for a long time, they describe it kind of as a job that's impossible to fail at. So it's a job that really set her up to look good, to succeed, but also to learn these issues and immerse herself in these issues so that she can speak comfortably about them publicly. She certainly wasn't enmeshed in them when she was governor of South Carolina, but she's done that for a while now. And she, like Tillerson, has distanced herself from the president on a number of things, but really on substantive foreign policy issues. So it will be interesting to watch her next week, though. I don't think she'll have a hugely public role. Again, kind of impossible to fail. But she really is a much more typical, traditional Republican, the sort of person, woman, minority, who Republicans kind of thought they'd be nominating in 2016, and potentially interesting to see her take on an even higher profile in the administration.
Holly, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you profiled Nikki Haley for the recent Politico 50 issue of Politico magazine, I think you described her as sometimes playing the good cop role to Trump's bad cop on the international stage.
That's right. And it kind of depends on your definition of good cop, bad cop.
Yes, it's
like
a very good point.
The cop that works, whatever it is. But yeah, I mean, she has this ability being, 200 miles away to kind of stake out certain positions that are somewhat at odds, at least publicly. But my understanding is that, the White House is well aware of this. They like having her out there taking these positions. They can point to her when people question what the administration has said or hasn't said about certain things. Just recently, she's been putting out statements, condemning the killings of the Rohingya in Myanmar, or Burma, as it's also known. And so the administration has been pointing to her statements as like, look, we're saying something about it. Whereas, what Bangladesh and other countries want is to hear something from President Trump or Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. So she fills this like very interesting role. Now, I think, if she does become Secretary of State, she's going to find it a much tougher situation because you actually have much more intense responsibilities in that position.
It is not a job that's impossible to fail at.
It's entirely possible to fail at. So, for instance, recently she's come out swinging against the Iran nuclear deal. And, she seems to be voicing Trump's position, which is that, of course, the U.S. has grounds to claim that Iran is not complying with this deal, even though international inspectors say that it is. Now, if you become Secretary of State, it's actually your official role. Like, you have a role in which you can go and, officially
Start to unravel.
Well, yeah. No, but yeah, I mean, you can go to the president and make a recommendation, you know, like you should waive the sanctions or you should certify that they are in compliance or not. And when she's going to have, you know, other countries telling her, hey, we think you guys need to stick with this deal. And she's Secretary of State and she goes, what is she going to tell the president? So, you know, it's going to be really fascinating if she becomes Secretary of State to see how she changes, if at all, to see how long she stays. It's a really, really interesting position for somebody who does seem to have a very bright future ahead of her in the Republican Party.
Back to the specific event next week, the General Assembly. What are we expecting from Trump's meetings and from his speech?
So what I am being told is that it's basically going to be a fairly scripted speech on Tuesday. It's kind of akin to the State of the Union, because there's a lot of different issues that he's going to want to discuss, including North Korea, UN reform, humanitarian crises, Syria, that sort of thing. What my understanding is that, you know, people are hoping he stays largely on script, both in those meetings as well as in the speech. But this is Trump, so you never know. You never know what is going to grab the moment and become the main story, even when they're trying to focus attention on something else.
But when you say people want him to stay on script, are you talking about American diplomats or our allies, or who are you talking about exactly?
His aides.
Oh, his aides.
His aides, U.S. diplomats. This is something they don't want him talking off the cuff in a situation like this. Now, that being said, you know, you're talking to a bunch of diplomats in a big hall, and they are not likely to boo you because they're trained not to do that. But this is Trump. This is just, you know, this is new territory in a lot of ways for the world to see this guy who so many of them are so incredibly skeptical of. Even the ones who say they love him, you know, like publicly, like privately, they're like, you know, and to see what he's going to say and what sort of things he's going to ask of the rest of the world, which I am told like is not surprising, but he wants them to share more of the burden at the United Nations. He wants them to help reform it. He feels like the UN. He said a lot of weird things about the UN, good and bad. But the latest thing is he thinks it has a lot of potential. And so
as a real estate investment opportunity on the building.
I mean, he did offer years ago to like renovate the building for hundreds of millions less. You know, it's just
that's amazing.
Yeah. One thing to watch for is whether Trump has an encounter with any top Iranian leader or whether Tillerson does as well. Mm-hmm. Sadly, we are told that Vladimir Putin will not be attending this year's General Assembly, so we're going to be deprived of that. But I would keep an eye on these encounters that may or may not happen and what comes of those.
Got it. Well, great. We will definitely be keeping an eye on that next week. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you for having me. Let's do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. Eliana, thank you for being here as always.
Thanks, Scott. Oh, and Scott's a new dad.
That's
we didn't
right.
even talk about that.
Yeah, I know. I was actually planning. This was a big plan to lure you all here just to look at pictures of my 3-week-old son for an hour. But
friend
but
Scott on Facebook.
We just blew right past that. So, but yeah, things are going pretty well.
Sam Bland.
Yeah. And it's going really well. It's going really well. He rolled over the other day, and I've like never been more proud of anything in my life. So. And Charlie, thank you for being here as well, as always.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, a big thank you to our listeners. Remember, if you have questions for the Nerdcast, please send us an email at nerdcast@politico.com. We love hearing from you. And also remember to subscribe, rate, and if you have time, write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform. Again, we love getting the feedback. We love spreading the word about the Nerdcast and trying to grow our audience. So please, you know, subscribe, rate us, and review us if you have time. So once again, thank you to our panel. Thank you to our listeners. As always, a big thank you to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, and today's producer, Matt Sobosinski, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, and Nerdcast researcher and Politico Playbook producer, Zach Montalaro. Thanks again for listening. We will talk to you again next week.